Hello, everyone. Welcome to another binary episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. Today, we have a bit of tool news with Binary Ninja releasing a free edition along with 4.0, some Linux kernel info leak stuff, some interesting research there, as well as the Nintendo versus Yaesu lawsuit news. We're going to talk about that a little bit. But we'll start off with Binary Ninja 4.0 and Binja Free coming out. So, yeah, this was something that's been in the works for a little while. They've been teasing some Binja 4.0 features in various blog posts, but the most notable thing to come out of it is the fact that a free edition has come for Binary Ninja, which is very nice, because one of the things that's always made it pretty difficult to recommend Binary Ninja is that it's a little bit of a steep cost for people that are getting into reversing and people that don't have the money to spend, where it's like a few hundred dollars a year. So, yeah.
And the cloud version has always kind of been... Like
it's not
free.
Really been that useful for trying it out.
Any non-CTF use case. Because I feel I'm not 100% sure on their size limitations there. Let me pull up the cloud site, see if it actually mentions it. But I think it's like 5 megabytes or something pretty small.
Or at least it was at one point, like when it first came out.
Yeah, well, that was something. So I pulled down Binary Ninja Free, just give it a shot. And like, you know, I used a file larger than the 5 megabytes. It was about 16 megabytes, so like a little bit larger. But yeah, I don't see them actually calling out that limit on their kind of homepage for cloud anymore. So
perhaps that might have been
I'm
removed,
mistaken.
Then.
Yeah, perhaps they're just not.
It was
in
there at some point. I'm almost certain of it. But yeah.
Yeah, well, they do say exact limits are not defined at this time, but will likely be for both binary sizes as well as functions and other internal performance limits. So perhaps they had it, now they've removed it or something like that. Either way, it does seem, I didn't try any massive binary, so like 16 megs is still on the smaller side for some things, but you know, it worked. You get it kind of right on your computer instead of going to the cloud. They only have the high level, so like your kind of pseudo C and like the high level IL.
Okay, I was about to ask options. If they had HLIL. That's good that they have it. It sucks that you don't get the lower IL levels, but there has to be some restrictions. So
and that's
expected.
Kind of the thing. Like, the thing is, like, to me, I talk about these a lot. Like, the ILs are the killer feature of Binja. To me, at least, like, they are the main thing that I like about them. I know you're kind of less on it, but, like, to me, it feels like a loss when that's still kind of, I believe Cloud still lets you use the ILs, just not the free version, but it kind of feels like a downside to me. But like, yeah, like I said, they have to have some restrictions, so fair enough. It's also some architectures that only supports like x86 and ARM, I think, for Binja Free, whereas Cloud does have more support. So like, you know, it's fair. I don't like think any of their restrictions on free are really too crazy or anything's wrong there. It does mean like you can give it a try. No API, which is to be expected.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm guessing there's no plugins or anything, right?
Yeah. Well, you get the debugger plugin, but no, like, random
plugins. No community plugins. Yeah.
Which, again, another hit, so, like, fair. But it is something you can try. It's another option that you can install and use kind of local performance, in a sense. So I'm definitely a fan of them putting it out there instead of just cloud, because I was never a fan of just cloud. So you can give it a try,
and
at least I did like some CTF problems with cloud, like nothing too special. Just like, yeah, it's usable, better than R2's cloud. I don't know about Ryzen, but well, I guess not cloud with R2, but web interface. I mean, I'm glad they've released it. You were kind of mentioning it, but, you know, people can at least try it now. And it's not, like, only cloud or pay, like, a few hundred dollars or their student pricing. But, yeah, it's an option. That's really what I want to call out with this. Just, it's there. You know, you can check it out now. It's something that can be recommended for free and is relatively usable.
Yeah, and I mean, it's good that you got a chance to try it and elaborate on what the limitations are. It's a good step. You know, it gives another option. And even just getting, like, the HLIL, like, that's pretty nice, too. Depending on how, like, I don't think there's any limitations on being able to configure the binary. So, yeah, the HLAL, like, in its own right can be useful. Just kind of talking about something you had mentioned there with me not caring about the ILs as much. Like, I do want to say, like, I do like the different IL levels. Where I find them mostly useful, though, is when I'm doing, like, plugin development. Especially if I'm writing a plugin for a custom architecture. Being able to use the ILs to see how the lifting is being done and track down issues is super useful, but that's not something you're really going to have to deal with in free because you can't run plugins anyway, so you don't have access to that API regardless. So yeah, for my use case, like, actually Binge of Free's limitations on the ILs isn't a huge deal, but yeah. Like you said, it's a nice step.
I kind of like the low-level IL because it's just like a very simple rewriting of assembly. Like, instead of a MOV into RAX, it's going to be like RAX equals whatever it was moving. Like, it's this really simple thing there. But then, you know, you switch onto another architecture, it's the same sort of thing. So just like genericizing the assembly in a sense, making it kind of easier to read if you're not as familiar with the assembly or like the specific syntax or whatever. Just slightly more convenient, or like switch there to see what it thinks is going on and stuff. Just like analysis and stuff is nice. It's some of like the mid level before some of the things have been entirely lifted.
Yeah, because some of the problems with HLIL is that it does like optimization passes. And if there's something wrong in the binary, like it has wrong section semantics or something or whatever, it'll just optimize out entire code blocks, which sucks. So that's where like the lower level ILs can come in handy too. But you can kind of fix those issues yourself by going into the segment editor and stuff. And like I said, it seems like they don't list that as a limitation.
It is there. That was something I actually checked out when I had.
Okay, good. Good. So yeah, it's cool that happened. There was also the 4.0 release, which was mostly like a UI refresh, although it was very welcome. I did appreciate it. It made opening things like cross-references and whatnot a lot more reasonable, whereas before they were kind of confined to a tiny window and there was just little annoyances with the UI that were addressed. There was also some improvements for Windows, including local and remote Windows kernel debugging. So Z and I don't really do the Windows research. I can't speak to how well that works, but it looks pretty cool. So for people who are doing Windows stuff, that might be something that's notable to you.
Yeah, actually, but the main thing I thought was kind of notable was just having the platform types and the kernel types, because I think when anybody just opens up like a Binja binary prior to 4.0, when is just looking at the decompiler and how good is the decompiler and like comparing that, they'll open it up and the first thing you'll notice is like, you know, it doesn't know necessarily a lot about these functions. Like, it, you know, kind of looks a bit messy, like, oh, it knows like function, but doesn't really know much about like the typing there. And
yeah, the type libraries is always where Binja's kind of fallen short.
When it comes
to Windows, at least.
Yeah. So even though the decompilation might be comparable to IDA, just without knowing like the names and everything of the types, it'll get kind of looked over because it's much more messy because of that. Whereas now, like, yeah, they actually have this like side-by-side comparison of the decompilations. You can kind of see like now it cleans it up quite a bit more in terms of what things are, and it kind of understands those functions, so it makes it much nicer to read. So I actually quite like that functionality. Like, that is actually kind of a big thing to me, just because of its lack of information in the past made the decompilation feel worse, even if it wasn't necessarily all that bad.
Yeah,
and obviously debuggers always kind of a welcome thing.
So yeah, I mean, we don't want to talk about the like new releases too much, but this one is fairly notable, and like you were saying, the Binary Ninja Free is what's the most notable there. Makes it a little bit more accessible for people who are coming into the binary space and need to do some of that reversing. So yeah, I wanted to mention that it, you know, it's out there and it's worth checking out.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, I'm a fan of Binja. I like their product. IDA's still kind of the leader on the decompiler, in fairness, but I don't like IDA as a company, so go Binja.
Yeah, fair enough.
And Ghidra's there, too. Ghidra's free. Ghidra is kind of my default recommendation if you're just getting started. But if you want to invest a little bit, I do think Binja is worthwhile.
Or at least worth checking out to see if it's worth it for your use case, because yeah. It is going to depend. Like we were saying with the Windows thing, like there's certain areas that Binja kind of falls short. Like iOS was one. I think that's something they've been working on as well. So yeah, at least now you can kind of trial it out more beyond than just what the cloud offered. All right, so we'll get into some of our research. So there was an interesting paper released by researchers at UC Riverside on automated generation of info leak exploits against the Linux kernel. And immediately when I saw this, when Z was talking about it on his prep stream, I was like, this sounds very similar in nature to a paper we covered a few years back called Kobe for automatic generation of exploits for out-of-bounds access issues in the kernel.
Yeah, Kobe is still kind of, not necessarily like absolutes or a favorite paper, but like definitely a memorable paper. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not sure if you have when we covered it.
I don't. Not on
so that we covered it on episode 29 back in February of 2020.
That's a while ago.
That was still our massive episodes. I'm actually, I had it up in another browser here, but I'll pull it off here with the podcast. Like, yeah, this was like a nice
two hour long
episode with a variety of issues. Yeah, we had the Kobe paper there for about 10 minutes. Yeah, but yeah, it sounded kind of similar in terms of what it was doing, but I'll let you keep going.
Yeah, so it does have some similarities. What the paper's main drive is the fact that InfoLeak vulns are difficult to automate with, like, anything. They're difficult to find automatically and pretty difficult to detect and sanitize for, too, because they can be caused by many different things, both temporal and spatial memory safety issues, and it doesn't really cause any obvious side effects that you can detect for. Despite that, info leaks are very valuable as a primitive and are necessary in a fair amount of exploit situations where you need to be able to leak pointers or something to defeat ASLR, for example. So they wanted to see if they could automate getting an info leak primitive from a memory corruption issue. So I will say that up front, they are focusing on that as a premise that they have an existing issue to exploit. They're not trying to find info leak bugs necessarily. Though it could kind of feed back into that too with like fuzzing or something potentially, but their focus here is on trying to create an info leak from an already broken state. And the way they ultimately go here is data flow analysis and static analysis tooling. Now, I don't want to get into all the data science specifics because a fair amount of it goes over my head. It's not really an area I have experience in. But at a high level, they're basically trying to see if sensitive info such as kernel pointers can somehow make its way into user space. They do that by doing some sync to source kind of analysis with the data flow graph. But where a typical data flow graph will assume intended data flows, theirs assumes unintended data flows. So they call it MDFG, or memory error augmented data flow graphs. And then they try to see if any of those found paths are actually viable to reach in a real world exploit scenario. Now, that's sort of half of the issue. The other half of the issue that they have to deal with here is the fact that modeling input in the kernel is really complicated. The route that most have gone for modeling input for the kernel is system calls, but system calls can have some interaction that's not straightforward, right? They can impact things in the kernel state that go beyond just the lifetime of that single syscall. And so that's where their static analysis framework comes into play, called Suter, where they can basically model cross syscall data flows. There's a lot of specifics in this paper that I'd recommend checking out if you want to know more of the details, but that's the high level of it, is that they can do the cross syscall data flows and combine those with the memory error augmented data flow graphs and combine those to get their info leak primitives. There's also some trade-offs that they had to make. So, for example, when searching the MDFG, they note that they prefer precision and reducing false positives compared to reducing false negatives, which when it comes to things like info leaks, I think that's a very fair choice. You want to reduce your signal to noise ratio because when something as monolithic as the kernel, that can very quickly explode. So yeah, but I did want to call that out because, you know, it is kind of a limitation in a sense. But yeah, they tested this on 250 bugs found by syscaller on Sysbot, and they were able to find and generate info leaks in 21 of them, many of which they state didn't have exploitability previously proven for getting an info leak. On page 12, they have like a table of results, some of which actually had multiple info leak paths. As you can expect, many of the ones that they were able to find info leaks there were with use after freeze, not so much on the out-of-bounds access. And that's not really surprising because UAF is generally a more powerful bug class, especially in the kernel where you can have such a degree of control and influence over the heap. But yeah, so it's kind of an interesting step to take. It's one that has always been neglected because it's just a really difficult problem to try to even detect info leaks, never mind try to automate the exploitation of them. But yeah, it's some very interesting research, and if this could be fed back into trying to find info leak issues as well and doing like sanitizers, that would be really useful. That said, I'm not sure on how feasible that would be, because when you're doing like this data flow analysis and static analysis, I don't think that would tie in very well with like fuzzing, for example. I think it would be too heavy. So I'm not sure if it would be able to be applied there, but some interesting research nonetheless.
Yeah, it feels like you're going to have a hard time necessarily applying this for just generic finding of info leaks. In large part, like, your stake kind of just expands quite a bit when you're not kind of having that initial starting place of a bug, and you're trying to detect if the bug happened at all.
You kind of have the state explosion issue, yeah?
Yeah, we just have so much possible scope going on there that it's going to be hard to properly detect. Unfortunately, when I saw the paper title, I was kind of hopeful that is actually what they were going for, is that they were trying to detect actual like info leak vulnerabilities in the Linux kernel, and having some way of detecting that, which is an area I really want to see more research in, or maybe I have to go and do research in, because like, you know, people have found these info leak bugs that are just like pure info leak bugs. Oftentimes when we talk about having an info leak, it ends up being like you have some other primitive and you've like turned your use after free, gives you an info leak primitive, and it gives you this, or your out of bounds read, you know, gives you an info leak, and your primitive of some other bug leads to the info leak rather than just these pure info leaks, which have been found also. I was kind of hoping you'd go in that because I think that is an important area of research, because it is kind of a necessary thing to figure out also. Like, you do often need an info leak. So those sorts of bugs, you know, are really hard to detect. I was kind of hoping you'd go that route. But this, like Spectre said, right now we've got kind of the issues where it is a lot of space to end up searching. There's a lot of kind of potential issues with applying this to that now. Could be a step in the right direction, and it's still something. It's just, it's less surprising to me that, hey, it is possible to get like a UAF out of, or sorry, to get a info leak out of a use after free. Like, you know, it feels like it's showing less, but it's still worthwhile. Like, it's still an important step. And so doing it here is still like a worthwhile thing. I don't want to hate on it for that. I was just hoping it was going in a slightly different direction, but I still appreciate what they've kind of done with this one.
Yeah, and I will say, even though it's somewhat obvious that in many cases you can derive an info leak from like a UAF in the kernel, actually being able to make that primitive work as an exploit dev can take some time and effort to go through. So this could save time and resources on that front too. Yeah, so that's like, where I think it could provide the value. But yeah, it's a bit more narrow scope than maybe you were expecting. But yeah, I think it's still pretty cool.
Yeah, it's totally fair. And it's kind of like the Kobe paper where, you know, like, it's not surprising you could take an out of bounds, like, you can get an exploit out of that, and you can maybe take it further than the proof of concept, like, get a further reach or whatever. It's been a while since I read that paper, so don't trust me for any details about, but, like, it was showing that, using fuzzing to automate that step, and that's kind of what they're going at here again, is they are starting to automate those steps of the exploit. So, you know, we have one thing about automating just the out of bounds aspect of it. This one's going for info leaks. Like, you know, they could very kind of nicely play together in a sense as part of just automated exploitation too. And sometimes you do have those cases where maybe you do just want fuzz and see if it finds something that you couldn't figure out, or you didn't notice the structure, like this layout or whatever, that is actually beneficial for you. Because like, that is a very tedious step, or can
be. And not only that, I think going into the future, that'll become more and more useful, because as we're seeing, especially with Apple, like, that's where my mind always jumps, exploit techniques that are common and generic are generally killed. They're almost considered vulnerabilities in and of themselves. So being able to automate primitive discovery in this way for hardened targets, I think could be useful more and more as time goes on.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Getting into our next topic, we have slides from Voidstar on a presentation given at Ring Zero, and it's about glitching in STM32 with electromagnetic fault injection, or EMFI. So this is some hardware stuff. Obviously, it's a little bit lower level than we typically cover, but what makes it cool and why I wanted to call it out is it's a setup that's actually accessible to people that don't work in labs with expensive equipment, which has always kind of been an issue with EMFI. It's hard to practically do in a lot of cases without good equipment because you do need that higher level of precision. It's not just like solder to a capacitor and try to drop the voltage or something. Like it typically requires more expensive equipment. But the goal of this presentation was to, you know, do the EM fault injection and do that with cheap hardware, so to speak. So yeah, going through the slides, they basically, so what their setup is they use like a 3D printer for a motorized XYZ stage. They also use the Pico EMP, which is like a cheap EMP emitting device you can get, and a custom inductor tip. And they talk about all the nuances of trying to exploit the STM32, trying to glitch the STM32 more specifically. So I think for people who are interested in hardware attacks, it's kind of a growing interest for me, so that's why I liked this. I think it's worth checking out. They talk about the like code patterns and stuff that you would try to glitch and where EMFI has the benefits over voltage glitching. Like they call it the fact that voltage glitching, it's more likely to brick and things like that. But there's just a lot of good information in here. So it's not a specific vulnerability or anything, but I think there's some useful information in there if you're interested in the hardware side. So wanted to give it a bit of a shout out, I guess, here.
Yeah, definitely. An interesting thing, like you said, because it is a low cost EMFI or for that type of fault injection.
Yeah, and I wish the presentation was out so that you had the audio context. That said, the slides are very easy to follow, even without that. So,
yeah, I'm just scrolling through the slides as you've been talking, and they do seem relatively good and easy enough to follow.
Yeah. All right, so we'll get into a bit of the news around Nintendo and Tropic Haze or Yuzu. So I'm sure a fair amount of people who listen to the podcast probably have heard of Yuzu before for Switch emulation. It's a pretty cool project, to be honest, from a technical standpoint. It's, you know, whenever you're emulating a full, like, modern console, like, that's quite an achievement. But yeah, obviously Nintendo didn't really vibe with that, so there was a lawsuit filed last week. And it seems that, you know, Yuzu's legal team folded pretty quickly. A week later, it was all settled for a $2.4 million settlement. And we're going to try to talk fairly carefully around this because I know it's kind of a boring thing to always have to listen to, but there's the obligatory neither Z or I are lawyers. We're just kind of two idiots in the legal sense, just having some opinions on it. So grain of salt and everything.
Some uninformed opinions, but there exactly. are opinions, so I care about them.
Yeah, exactly. So I have read through the legal documents. So the one that we have up here is the initial lawsuit with the preliminary statement and everything. And we also have the documents for the final judgment and whatnot. But a part of why I wanted to talk about this is it's been widely circulated as an attack on emulation. So that's kind of how people have been talking about it. And I don't really think that's fair. I think it's leaving out a lot of nuances with what Nintendo has argued. Now, I will say up front, like, I'm not a huge fan of how these big corporations like Nintendo and Sony and such wield the American judicial system against people. And obviously, like, some of you listening know, I do some console work. Like, I work in the PlayStation scene. And so that has always been something that lingers in the back of your mind, that you want to be careful when you're doing console work to not step on the toes of these companies and make them come after you, because if they do, it's not a good time for you, as indicated by the $2.4 million settlement. So yeah, so it's been taken as an attack on emulation. Part of what I think is being left out here is the fact that Yuzu was taking donations and money for the work they were doing in the emulation, which on the one hand, you know, emulating a modern console is a lot of work. I won't try to downplay that. It's a crazy amount of effort that has to go into it. But whenever you start taking money for doing console modding stuff and making money off of, making money off of like the intellectual property of Nintendo in this instance, you are kind of playing with fire. And I think that is ultimately what got them burned here. So I think that's worth mentioning as well. But one of the main arguments by Nintendo that's a little bit interesting is the fact that you have to dump your console's keys, right, in order to use Yuzu, in order to be able to decrypt all of the games and whatever to run on the emulator. You need those keys. And of course, whenever you're talking about keys, it's a very touchy subject because keys are considered like intellectual property. The obvious big elephant in that space was the PlayStation 3 days, where they went after Geohot for the ECDSA keys at that time, private keys. So keys are considered like intellectual property. It's not something you want to redistribute. So in order to try to get around that, Yuzu had like a guide on how to dump keys from your own console. And then you would place those in like a special directory and Yuzu would require those to run, but they wouldn't be redistributing the keys directly, right? But Nintendo still argued that basically, because in order to use Yuzu, you had to pull those keys and use like their intellectual property, that that was a violation or whatever, a copyright violation. So there's some interesting discussion with keys. And Z, you had mentioned that this has kind of been tested in court before.
Not entirely. One thing I do just want to mention, though, is that everything that seems like has been going on here, like nothing in the actual complaint from Nintendo comes down to they're emulating the device. It's always about the keys, access to the keys. Like everything comes around to that and not the actual whether or not the emulation is lawful. It did kind of remind me of two things. One was just the PSX2 emulator. You know, it requires you bring the BIOS files. So it is different. It's not keys there. I'm actually not entirely sure what information is there that it's actually copying but that it needs out of that. But like that was something they couldn't provide because that was Sony's IP. And so like it feels like Yuzu's kind of copying the same thing where that I believe they have their own kind of implementation of like the core Switch firmware. And then, you know, just for these keys, they're actually copying them. Now, it did remind me a little bit of the Sega versus Accolade case, which is definitely different. Sega versus Accolade basically just had Accolade was making their own Sega Genesis cartridges for their games. And part of doing that meant they had to make like interoperate with the Sega Genesis console. And in doing so, there was this like trademark safety system or safety chip or whatever on the Genesis that would look for the Sega trademark, like literally SEGA bytes on the data. And then it would display like the Sega logo with that. And so Sega made the claim that because they had to include like Sega there and were showing the Sega logo, they were infringing their trademark or their copyright. I forget which exactly that case went with. But they were going for some sort of infringement there, and thus, you know, it's a whole issue because they were copying it. But the way the courts came down on it initially was against Accolade. Then on appeal, that got overturned, and basically the precedent that came out of it was like, you know, that sort of copying, if it's necessary for interoperability, so you could perhaps make the claim about like interoperability of being able to play the games that you have bought on another device, which is something that felt weird to me about this whole complaint from Nintendo, is they often talk about being played on unauthorized devices. In other words, without Yuzu's decryption of Nintendo's encryption, unauthorized copy of games could not be played on PCs or Android devices. So like complaining about the fact that you're playing it somewhere else, that something else is interoperable with their thing, which is an exception in DMCA. But just because it's an exception DMCA, you can't break any other like copy protection mechanism and stuff, which is probably where they're able to still make the claims here. But I don't know. That complaint did feel a little bit weird to me, but you know, my experience here comes from doing the work on like the Save Metal Gear Online project and kind of reproducing a game server. So pretty different. And I talked with the lawyer more on that aspect than how you would apply the interoperability to this sort of keys and emulators. But nonetheless, there was that case that at least had some case of copyright infringement or like copying the trademark of something as being allowed as part of interoperability. And this at least seems to be kind of an interoperability thing to me, nonetheless, they did settle. Like, this is a settled thing. It's not still going through court. They settled. So, you know, whatever the details are here, and probably taking money did have something to do with that. I'm not sure if any of the other emulators really take money in the same way Yuzu was. Maybe donations? I'm not even sure about that. Like, does Dolphin even take donations? Like, oh no, Yuzu was kind of selling its features though. Like, it had the whole early release thing, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I was going to get to. I'm not deeply entrenched in the emulation scene, but from what I've heard, like, Yuzu was making a lot of money from it.
Yeah, that was something, like, when I talked with a lawyer about the Metal Gear Online server I was working on, like, that was actually my big takeaway. Don't take money. Like, don't give them any reason to go after you, because, you know, even if you might be able to win a case, you're probably not going to be able to beat their lawyers.
Yeah, like, that's the thing that kind of sucks with how the American legal system is wielded, is that it doesn't really even matter, technically, if they have, like, a legal case to stand on. They're just going to drown you in the legal system and legal fees. Like, you're not in a position, it's not a fair fight. It's just not one you want to put yourself into. So by taking money, and the other thing that they argue here is the fact that Yuzu was kind of flexing that they were able to run games and run the latest Zelda game before it was even released. And they were kind of they claim here that they were locking that behind their, like, Patreon donations, which with things like that, like, it's, you're really poking the bear, especially with Nintendo. Nintendo is the thing to point to as the most litigious company that there is in the game space. It's really not a bear you want to poke. So it's kind of hard to feel sympathy for Yuzu here, and I feel like I'm kind of in the minority on that. But there are some interesting things when it comes to the keys, because these consoles love to add encryption layers on their system firmware and their libraries and their games and everything, where it's like you have the keys stored on the console that aren't easy to get at. So it's like, of course, you can't really redistribute those keys because they're considered intellectual property. But in order to run, like, if you wanted to write custom firmware or edit the firmware and you had some bug, let's say, to be able to do that, you would still need to have the system be able to decrypt it into valid data. So in order to do that, any tools that you build would need to use those keys. So if they can claim that, like, just building tools and using tools that use keys that you dump from your console yourself is, like, an illegal action, then that's not a very good thing.
It's concerning, yeah.
It's concerning.
It feels like those keys on a console I own, like, I didn't rent it from Nintendo. I do own the console. I mean, they probably do want to have you rent it, but at this point, like, it is a physical device that you are an owner of. And so, like, usually this feels like some of that fits into what's usually acceptable with your device. Like, getting those keys might be difficult, but it's still acceptable to do for your own device because it is your device, and then using it somewhere else.
It's generally been the distribution, like, the redistribution of the keys that's been attacked, not getting them.
It does feel a little bit concerning around the key management stuff. At the same time, it definitely feels like Yuzu was maybe stepping over a few lines here. But at the very least, it doesn't look like this is coming down to emulation specifically. This doesn't seem to be saying you can never emulate something or, like, coming down entirely against emulation. It does seem to be more about the protective measures that the consoles do have.
Yeah, which it's is still things important. That get in the way of emulation. Yeah. Basically, it's things, problems that they had to solve to in order to do it. But
yeah, but not directly emulation.
But yeah, so part of what I was focusing on and what kind of kickstarted the discussion and like some discourse that I'm in is the fact that in the final judgment exhibit, they have this bullet point. So bullet point 5, the court further orders, blah, 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 upon Nintendo's election, and to the extent controlled by the defendant, the destruction and deletion of all circumvention devices, including all copies of Yuzu. So that makes sense that, you know, that would be destroyed. But also tools used for developing or using Yuzu, such as Hecate, Atmosphere, Tigra ROM, GUI, Blockpick, RCM, NX Dump Views, and Tigra Explorer, and things like that. Which, that's kind of where, it seems like other tools are kind of getting caught in the crossfire here, because these other tools are used, like, they're basically like payloads you can run in order to dump the fuse contents that contain the keys of your console. So that's where it's a little bit worrying, like, hitting these other potential projects. Like, Yuzu specifically, I don't care about. Kind of like what you said, I feel like they probably did cross over a line, especially when it comes to, like, accepting money and stuff. But, like, these other tools also being mentioned here in the document is kind of where it's a bit more concerning for me, at least. So I think people are kind of focusing on the wrong thing. They're focusing on emulation, and I don't think emulation's being really attacked here. But when you're talking about tools for dealing with your, like, data that resides on your own device, that's where the concern should be, I think. Because I don't think that's right, that they should be able to enforce what you do with data that's on your own console if you go through all the effort and things needed to do that. Like, I'm not saying that they should make it so that the keys are advertised where it's like, oh yeah, just go into a menu and here they are. Like, I'm not saying they should have to do that, but if you are able to pull the keys, I don't think they should be able to dictate that, like, you can't build any tools that use them. I don't like that. So
yeah, I guess it comes down to, is the point of the tool going to be for piracy in particular?
Yeah, like, if you're going after tools that are explicitly enabling piracy, that's fine. Like, that's reasonable, I think.
And that is what DMCA is kind of about there when it comes to the protective countermeasures and all of that. Whereas, you know, when tools do just have the homebrew impact, going after all of this feels like it's also just going after homebrew.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I did want to talk about it a little bit because I feel like there's a lot of people that have been talking about it and maybe not even really read the legal documents because they're just kind of talking about, like, you know, the high-level emulation is being attacked, you know, and I think there's more to talk about there. But, yeah, as we said, where we don't have the legal expertise, like, Z has talked to lawyers a little bit about something kind of adjacent to it, but...
Yeah, the wider impact concerns me for sure.
Yeah, and it kind of sucks too, because I remember talking, like, not even a few months ago about the fact that it seems like these companies have kind of calmed down. We didn't really have any major lawsuits in the console space for a while, at least not ones that weren't, like, very obvious slam dunk, like, going after piracy directly. I think there was kind of cases with that, with Sony, with some of the, like, dupe tricks that people were doing to duplicate games across systems. But yeah, when it comes to things that could impact homebrew, like, it's been a while since that's happened, and it's resurfaced. So yeah, here we are again.
It's definitely unfortunate. It feels like with Yuzu specifically, they got a little bit too cavalier. It's like the Zelda game you talked about there was being distributed on their own Discord and stuff. So, like, you know, not really separating themselves from the non-piracy, non-infringing use cases, which is usually kind of a big deal.
Yeah, so it was noteworthy, and, you know, it kind of impacts the space that I work in a little bit, or it's adjacent to it, but yeah, you know, obviously can't comment too much on it definitively, and just have some of those discussions around our interpretations of it. And that's kind of where we have to leave it. We do have a few shoutouts in this episode, and I'll let Z get into them, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, so when it comes to the shoutouts here, I've got one here that is finding gadgets for CPU side channels with static analysis tools. Kind of a fan here, because if you scroll down just a little bit, you'll see CodeQL, and then you'll see, you know, CodeQL code. And, you know, I just like CodeQL, so here's something with CodeQL. But being a bit more serious, what I actually kind of want to call it here is I often talk about using CodeQL, not as, like, you're going to go run the entire test suite of CodeQL queries, which is a viable thing to do, but that I feel like CodeQL is great as a researcher in the loop tool, where you're using it to assist in you looking for specific things in a set of code. And that's kind of what's going on here. They're using CodeQL to find Spectre V1 gadgets that they can use for, like, CPU side channels. They're using CodeQL to try and find that because they understand what they need to do, they understand what they need to look for, and now CodeQL is how they can express that kind of what they want to look for and what they want to query for. It is a powerful tool for using it on these really kind of niche specific cases. Not many people are going to need to run this CodeHeal code, but as a specific researcher with a specific task, you can kind of write it to fill in on these sorts of specific tasks that you want to complete. So yeah, I just thought it was neat to see it there. It is also just kind of a neat tool, how they're using it there also. But yeah, just kind of a use case of CodeQL to think about. Then getting into the second shout out, not going to spend too much time with this, but Q4 of 2023, Q4 ThinkEscapes came out, where they just kind of lay out some of the good research that came out. It's going to be blog posts, it's going to be conference presentations and papers and all of that that came out in the last quarter. So kind of doing like, you know, looking at the latest research like we do on the podcast, but also a little bit different because they only go quarterly. But yeah, they've just released Q4. So figure I'd just give you guys a shout out, or give it a shout out, let you guys know about that if you want to check it out.
So that's all the shout outs that we have. So thank you to everyone who tuned in. Feel free to join the community by joining our Discord and Twitter. Links are in the description. And again, I've been kind of struggling on the topics. If you find something that we miss, feel free to drop it in the links and news channel. The struggle for vulnerabilities and stuff continues. So, but yeah, so that's everything, and we'll see you next week.